Hi, this is Fabi Fab.
And this is Babelito.
And we are Latinos Who Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like...
Why fart and waste it when you can burp and taste it?
Hello, hello, hello.
Que show, que show, que show.
You okay, Babelito?
I'm all right.
Oh my gosh, we're going to get right to it. We have a very special guest here at the Latinos Who Lunch headquarters in downtown LA. Shout out to Molcajete Dominguero. We're borrowing their offices here and talking to some of the most important people here in the scene. And today we have Dr. Denise Sandoval. How are you?
I'm fine.
Ready to taste it.
Oh, shit. Speaking of taste, what have you eaten today? Tell me.
I have not eaten something very appetizing. It was called whatever's in the fridge. Yeah. Leftover chicken, a salad, watermelon. That was really good. And that's it.
Oh, man.
Man, I need some cookies. I still have that box of Girl Scout cookies for you.
Oh, my gosh.
I forgot to bring them.
So I stayed with Denise a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And she had a bunch of Thin Mints, right?
In the freezer.
And she's like, hey, girl, I got Thin Mints, and they're in the freezer. I said, what? Duh, get them out here. Oh, my God.
Do you guys watch movies or something?
We watched them separately.
You know, we just sort of talked a lot of cheese meh, ate Thin Mints.
Weren't we watching a Janet Jackson concert?
We did something. I don't know. It's all a blur.
Anyway, let's give you a proper introduction. Dr. Denise Sandoval is a curator, an academic, professor, an all-around badass, and we're so happy to have her on the podcast. Currently, I'm in an exhibition at the Peterson Automotive Museum that she curated about lowriders, mm-hmm. actually about art about lowriders, and there's lowriders in the show that I would consider art, which are just... amazing. And the name of the show is
The High Art of Riding Low, and it's at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. We've been there for over a year. It got extended for this summer, so it'll be there till early September.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
So I want to know, how did you become the lowrider curator? Because I know that you have curated so many shows now surrounding lowrider culture.
Yeah, it's actually a great story that I actually begin every class session telling my students when I introduce myself, because I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley in a city called La Puente. So my parents mm-hmm. are typical, Chicano LA story. My roots begin in the east side. Grandma still lives in East LA. My mom grew up there, dad in Lincoln Heights. They followed the 60 freeway out after my dad came back from Vietnam to buy a house and settled in La Puente, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to 12 years of Catholic school. So low riding was always in my neighborhood, and I have this really vivid memory when we would cross on Fridays, we would always go to church and then cross the street to go to school. I went to St. Joseph's in La Puente.
And shout out.
There would be this low rider that would sometimes cruise in the morning. And, as kids, you're like, oh, bad. And the nuns would be like, stop, don't look, don't cross the street. Don't look at the cholos. Because there would always be cholos that would play in this park behind our school, So there was always this something, obviously sexy, when you're young and captivating, right? So what was crazy is it was always in my environment, though my family didn't have low riders. I didn't know anybody that had low riders, right? But it was really when I landed on the campus of UC Berkeley for my undergrad years, and I found old issues of Lowrider Magazine in the Chicano Studies Resource Library. That doesn't exist anymore because now they have an ethnic studies library.
Oh, my God.
So I look at these magazines, and I'm like, what is this? This is great, And I even did, a little report for a class on, the women, women's and bodies and sexism, and I used some issues of old Lowrider Magazine. Nice. This was in the early 90s, right? Cut to the chase. I'm in grad school working on my PhD, taking a class on popular culture. Had a really cool teacher that said, choose a popular cultural space to study and write about for this course, right? Mm. And so I was trying to get inspiration, and so I went down to Tower Records, which no longer exists.
Oh, I miss Tower Records.
To get inspiration, pass by the magazine rack, take a few steps back. I was like, what is that? looks like Lowrider magazine, but there's a Japanese girl on the cover in the bikini. What is this? Start opening this up. You know, this is like the 90s, like 97, 98. Open it up, and it's all in Japanese. You know, there's Japanese guys dressed like cholos, homeboys. It looks like it's East LA, but it's Japan, right? So I thought, wow, this would be really great to write a paper for my class, right? Yeah. Went to the library to do research because I'm so old. You had to literally do library and the research back then.
Shout out to the Dewey Decimal System.
Because the dial-up was so slow, right? And there's all these codes you had to put in, right? To like log on to libraries, right? It's just easier to just go to the library, right? Yeah. And pull out the cards or use their. So I typed in lowriders and lowriding, and I found a few academic articles, mostly on the Southwest, like New Mexico, but no books, Española, right? Yeah. So I thought, well, I can't do the paper, but my professor was like, no, you can. She's like, you have these old issues of Lowrider magazine, because we even had some at Cal Poly Pomona. I was working as an academic counselor at Cal Poly Pomona. Mm-hmm. And she's like, there's books on hot rod and hot rod culture. You can contextualize it. So I did the paper. Literally, I kid you not, I wrote that paper in like May of 98. 6 months after that, the Peterson Automotive Museum was looking to hire a curator community researcher for their first exhibit on low riding.
Wow.
So I applied and got the gig because they got me really cheap. And then that became my entry because I was able to go into the field and say, hey, you know, I'm doing this project for the Lowrider Magazine. You know, my family's from East LA. I want to be a Chicano studies professor. And people just like opened up, all these guys opened up, you know? And so it was great because the Lowrider guys knew that the Peterson was a very prestigious museum mm-hmm. in Los Angeles for automotive history and culture. Most of their shows were like on the Woody or in like sports cars, like very white car culture, hot rods. So they realized sort of the racial politics as well. And with that first exhibit, we broke attendance records in that museum. They saw the most black and brown people, surprise, surprise, in this museum because it opened up in February 2000. Mm-hmm. So literally that job allowed me to do my research for my dissertation and the field work, right? And so it was interesting how like I always share that with my students. I share a shorter version, but because as a student, I began to think about the world I was living in and the world that I was seeing and beginning to realize that the language that I grew up with, college gave me the language to understand it, right? Mm-hmm. And that I think one of the big sort of mantras I got from UC Berkeley, because my professors at Berkeley in the 90s were the ones who helped establish ethnic studies and were part of the Third World Strike. Mm-hmm. And Ronald Takaki, you know, the godfather of ethnic studies, was one of my professors. You know, one of the things that I left Berkeley with is you need to be part of the solution, right? Ooh. And that who's going to write our stories? Yes. We're going to write our stories, right? And it's something I still share with my students. So it was just, it's interesting because that first exhibit was so great. You know, I wrote about it. I never thought I'd do a second exhibit, right, in 07, 08, or a third exhibit, or I would be known as like the lowrider chick, right, lowrider scholar. I never thought.
That's a pretty cool title, though,
is kind of, you know, but it's the fascinating thing. It's I'm never tired talking about lowriding. I'm still so passionate about it. And I see my role as being like an ambassador, an educator, as well as scholar, because, you know, people have a lot of negative perceptions about low riding and low riders and who these people are, right?
And in turn, our neighborhoods and our, in turn, like our communities in general, when they have those bad perceptions. But I want to touch upon something very different, very interesting that you said. You talked about how the museum was surprised of having all these brown and black audiences arriving. And we talk about this in the podcast a lot. When it comes to diversifying spaces, it's not just about a couple of employees. You have to go from the root. Right. And the fact that they got you as a curator, that showed all the way to the assistants because you know what your community wants and what your community needs.
Right. And here's a perfect example. You know, I was like 27, 28, and, you know, when I was sitting at that table that first time, I was the only person of color at that table. Mm-hmm. It was all white people. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that has continued to be my experience in various spaces, right? But the question I got asked was, is it true that they call those cars lowriders from smuggling illegals in the trunk of the car crossing over the border?
Fuck that. Oh, my God.
And I heard they said some other racist thing to me. So you're in this part, and I'm a little young. I feel like I'm better at handling those. But I kind of actually just started laughing Yeah. And I said, oh, yeah, that's how my family crossed over. No. And then I educated them. But I think those moments where I take that responsibility is that on one hand, I always see myself primarily in speaking for this community, right? And always their interests and always making sure that the story is right for them, mm-hmm. right? And honest to who they are. But the other side is that our responsibility as cultural brokers, right? With these institutions yeah. and the education that has to happen around issues still around race, class, gender, sexuality, documentation status, yeah. you know, that are still relevant today.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel that it was an education experience because nobody sort of taught me this. I had to like learn by sitting at table after table where like there's that white privilege, right? The white supremacy that mm-hmm. exists in these institutions. And some of them who think they're tolerant or culturally sensitive. but it's
air
just
quotes.
It's racist, right?
Yes.
And so just learning how to react to those situations.
So when you have to navigate those situations in those spaces, what kind of strategies have you used and what kind of advice you can give to our audiences? Because that's a recurring problem and letters that we get that a lot of our listeners made it into that job they've been looking for, right?
Yes.
And then they have to navigate these situations, this micro, which they never microaggressions. Right. There always are macroaggressions.
So let me be honest with you. I think if I was a Chicano man, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to experience some of the things I have to deal with.
Mm.
Because I'm a woman, mm-hmm. I get talked down a lot.
And is it because of the low riding community or is
no,
it because
no, no.
of the museum?
I'm talking about institutions.
Okay.
White men, white women, you know, they like talk down to you. You know, put down your nose. I mean, and it's even more aggravating when it's people that are like 15, 20 years younger than me, you know, that are in their 20s. You know, I'm 47, right? I would never treat somebody
Girl,
like
you
that,
look good.
Right? Thank you.
Damn.
It's
Avon, okay? My mom's an Avon lady. I've been using a new product since I was 18, 19.
Girl, you are glowing.
So I think in those situations, like, one of the things is they raise their voice, they have attitude with mm-hmm. you. So you could give it right back, but you have to sort of be even keel. You know, and the crazy thing is I can go zero to chola really quick. And when shit goes down, I'm like ready to throw down, right?
Yeah.
But you have to keep in check, right? Because sometimes, like when you start lowering your voice, like then they realize like how silly they look.
They look asinine with their voice.
So I think one thing is that because of my age now, like think about when I first knew I was 27, 28. I would say now at 47, like no one's going to take away my voice.
Right.
You know, and if I have issues, people are going to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to, you know, and sometimes I have to call out people. You know, this is unacceptable for you to be yelling at me like this. You know, wow. We're both dealing with this problem. So let's come up with a solution. You know, like, and there were some issues with some people having some issues with even some of my lowriders and treating them. And I get two sides of the story. And I said, you know, literally, this is a communication problem because so-and-so is viewing it this way and yours. So, like, what's the solution?
Yeah.
Because both of your perspectives are right, right? So I always try to go into education mode of, like, mm-hmm. how we can sort of, because that's, I think, our all-star role.
Yes.
Right? And I feel because of my age now, even though I still get treated a certain way, I do have a certain type of
control,
cultural power and capital mm-hmm. that I do have with my age now mm-hmm. that I probably couldn't have said certain things in at 27, 20s. 28. Or mm-hmm. I wouldn't have had the insight at that age. There's something about getting older and the wisdom that you get by navigating life,
yeah.
right? That's also really important. But I think that's the idea of that my advice would be to claim your voice, right? And we have to just find the right language and right approach. And that can be the difficult part because the burden is deep for us because we're the ones that I go home with the migraine or I'm sick to my stomach because I'm having, you know, to have this side of my community always on my side and my social justice hard on my sleep.
Yes.
But on the other hand, like I realize the importance of being in these spaces and speaking for my community and speaking for myself.
And I also, the fact that you give your experience in the beginning of your classes, it's so important.
Right.
Because as an undergrad, I had one brown professor. And that class changed my entire life.
Right. Because
I had so many classes by white professors teaching me about European history and European art history. The second I took a Chicano literature class, just to see that presence in front of me as an authority and hearing about his experiences made me feel like I could do it, right? So I also made it a point that normally I don't want to be called like Dr. Ortega or whatever, but in the classroom, because my classrooms in UNLV are very diverse, I want to make sure that people know that I made it all the way through and that if they want to, they also could do it. So because there's not a lot of us over there. And given those experiences, and I do that all the time, I always talk about my experience in a museum or like things that I lived through, Justin's experiences also in those spaces.
Mm-hmm. Something that I want to ask you is like, how did you, I mean, something that I always think about is like, in order to be something, like you are an academic now, you had to see it or be encouraged by somebody to do it. Do you come from a family of academics?
No,
or how did that happen?
So, you know, my parents, classic story, you know, they got married at 20. My dad's a Vietnam vet. My mom had two kids by 22, 23. So, but what they did was my parents struggled to provide us Catholic education, you know, and sent us to a really good high school, Bishop Aumont, that was a college prep out in La Puente. So I think for me, I always knew I was going somewhere. And the funny thing is that Girl Scouts also played a big role in my life.
Oh.
My mom was my Girl Scout leader at like 10, 11, because there were like no Chicana Girl Scout leaders in La Puente. And so through Girl Scouts, I also learned the power to take up space in the world and that anything was possible. And I was lucky to have a mom, even she grew up very repressed, was like, you know, the only way you're leaving a house is if you're married or dead type of a life, right? Very Mexican way type of thing. I was lucky to have a mom that like created opportunity, you know, with sort of that wind beneath my wings, as that's her quote, that she loved, you know, for providing for her children and inspiration. So I think I always knew I was going to go to college and be something. I always thought I was going to be a lawyer. I mean, I was planning to be a lawyer till my last year at Berkeley. And then I took a class on Chicanos in the criminal justice system taught by Larry Trujillo, amazing professor, a very political professor. And I did some internship where we went to Vacaville Prison as part of that class. And then I was like, damn it, I can't be a lawyer. You know, like the system is so messed up, but I had no black backup plan. So I think what I tell my students of how I got here, I think what I learned through my life is to have a plan A, B, C, and D.
Yes.
Because I didn't. I put all my eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
And when law school wasn't there, I go, fuck, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I thought I had failed. Here I was at Berkeley. The only thing I had was a love for Chicano studies and ethnic I majored in ethnic studies. So I ended up at CSUN, you know, to get my master's because I knew I had a love. And they were the ones that threw me in the classroom to start teaching. And I realized I had a love for teaching, you know, and then I realized that I wanted to come back and teach at CSUN. And that's the whole reason why I got my PhD. So I think it's a good lesson for our students to share our lives.
Yes.
Because one of the things is being able to trust your intuition and trust that inner voice that somehow you don't know why you're going through this path. But that has never gotten me in trouble in my life. It's to this day, that's what I follow. But when you're young, you don't know because people are saying, oh, don't do that or don't. You're not going to get.
It costs too much money.
I mean, how many times I had family saying, what are you going to do with Chicano studies? You know, what can you do with a major? And I never had problems getting jobs. And I was an academic counselor.
Right.
I've done a lot of different things in administrative in the university system because it's your work experience that gets you that.
Did your parents ever question it?
No, they really sort of like trusted. And, you know, I always worked full time. I had two jobs when I was working on my PhD.
Damn.
I always worked. I was always a workhorse. And it's funny. So I don't have any intellectuals, academics in my family in the traditional sense. Right. But my brother is a professor of Chicano Latino history at Pomona College. He got his PhD in history at Berkeley. So he went to Claremont McKenna. I went to Berkeley and then we kind of switched, right? I went to the Claremont Graduate School for my program in cultural studies and then he went up to Berkeley. And he's a historian and, you know, It's crazy that my parents, and my sister just got her EDD from USC 2 years ago in education, and she runs the housing at USC. Wow. Like probably the so first Chicana to run the housing. I told my parents, awesome. How did you do this? Not one kid went left, you know?
It's not too late.
It's pretty great, you know, to... I know, but we're very active committed. And me and my brother both do like interviews and oral history and community history. So I think it's important, right, that students, that if you don't have that example for you, you're going to find it on your path. But it's going back to trusting your voice and taking a risk to take a step in a direction that you feel yourself drawn to.
Yeah,
totally.
And that's so. Do you always knew that you were going to be an artist?
You know, I never saw an example of an artist that looked like me or like did things that I do now. So I was always really creative and I knew that I was going to do something creative, whether it be teaching or with music, but I never expected to be a visual artist. And it was actually really hard for me growing up because my family would make fun of me for being creative. Like, here's Justin and one of his creations. Oh, like, they would make fun of me for, like, making birthday cards for people. Like, it was not a good thing. So I had to fight. I still am fighting for, like, validation. Like, hey, look, what I'm doing is actually paying my bills now. And now they're like, oh, shit. And I remember my tia Julia, fuck, that lady is such a hater. And I live for her. She used to say she didn't like my cousin Eric hanging out with me. And she would say, ay, no me gusta que estés con ese Justincito siempre con sus inventos. Like, they hated that I was a creative person. Oh, it's so crazy. So that's why I asked you that question. Like, who in your family, like, showed you that it was okay to follow whatever path you wanted? But I did meet your parents. Yeah, and they're super supportive. Your dad's an actor.
Yeah, my dad got into, he was always an artist, but he worked for the phone company and managerial before he retired.
Yeah.
And he didn't use creativity. So when he retired, he went straight to all the things that he used to do as a kid of like painting and drawing and, you know, taking music lessons and acting. So he definitely is an artist. So it's funny because I feel like he came alive, you know, through retirement. I think creativity is so important.
Yes.
What Fabi Fab is talking about, because I see it, you know, I've been teaching for over 20 years. The one thing I'll give these millennials that are coming in, and keep in mind, I'm scared, this generation, these freshmen I'm going to see this fall, were born in 2000. It's our first years born in 2000.
Oh my God.
They're literally 21st century babies. That's scary,
right?
I'm dead.
I'm going to die.
I'm not getting introductory classes this year, so I'm going
to
skip
that. I always do intro classes. They're very creative, you know, because I do this exercise in my Intro to Chicano Culture class, which is literally culture class, understanding how culture works and identity. At the end, they do a cultural identity presentation. Mm-hmm. What I've seen in the last 5 or 6 years is how many of them are creative in the arts. Like, they might be majoring in business, but they create zines, they build robots, they do all this and all this stuff. And I'm like, what? Like, I wouldn't see that back in the day.
Yeah.
So I feel that there's a nurturing of that creativity in the millennials, you know, that's amazing, you know, that I didn't see, you know, when I started.
Yeah. And I think it's the internet. They have everything in their disposal. Yeah. Anything they can think about, they'll find that example.
Like cartoonists wanting animation. That. Yeah, yes. It's amazing.
Like, if we thought about something, it's not like we could just go to the internet and look for it. I mean, or neither in the library. Right. So I've been thinking about art since I was like 11 when I first saw a book of Salvador Dalí. But as institutional thing, as a career path, it wasn't until I was in my 20s. Right. I was like, oh, shit. This thing that I've been thinking about for 10 years since I was a kid, I can actually make a living out of it. But it really took that long. It wasn't like I could just go online and Google it.
Right.
So yeah, and I see that too. With
yeah,
students.
And making music. Like, yes. I have so many musicians, and they're like, "Here's my SoundCloud, here's my music," and I'll be like, "Wow, this is great," you know. So there's a lot of other things that they lack in skill set. That's a whole other conversation that I don't want to get a headache out of. Yeah, and not listening. They don't take notes.
Like, my favorite is when I turn off the lights because it's in art history, so I always have PowerPoints, and all their faces light up like this blue green color because they have their phone. And they think I don't see, but I can see everything.
You don't have in your syllabus. I have in my syllabus, if I catch you with your phone, you get kicked out of class and lose attendance points.
No, because I tried that before and it was more interrupting.
Yeah.
So I just give them the same speech in the beginning of class.
Yeah.
If you're putting money into this. Your right. parents are putting money. And if you don't care, there's right. the door. And there's always those 10 people that don't give a shit. Yeah. And there's always yeah, those 10 people who seem like yeah. you changed their life. So that's change. All yeah, that's I'm good.
True. I yeah. love it. I'm like you. There's the door. I'm yeah. like, to me, that's the 12 years at Catholic school that I survived of the nun. Like I tell my students on the first day, besides telling the story so that yeah. they know that I mean business, I said, there's two spirit animals that live in me. One is a Carmelite nun. Full habit Carmelite nun. You know, that's where I survived 12 years of Catholic school. And I grew up in La Puente, and there's also a chola uh-huh. on the other shoulder. And so their goal is to keep me happy in the middle. Because the chola and the nun are actually friends. Different sides of crazy, right? Yeah. On different sides of the coin, but they're both crazy,
yeah.
right? And so they start laughing. And then sometimes during the semester, they go, is that the nun coming out? They're like, is that the chola? But I'm honest with my students first day, you know?
Yeah, you have to.
So let's go back a little. So you teach at CSUN?
I teach at Cal State Northridge.
Oh, my
otherwise
gosh.
Otherwise known as CSUN.
And then you, what are the classes that you teach there?
So right now, I've kind of been stuck teaching like first-time freshmen, which I don't mind. It's a lot of work, and I love getting them. Intro to Chicano Culture, mm-hmm. And then a History of the Americas, which is like a Title V history class. So it's pretty much like U.S. history, some of Latin American history told from the person of color perspective, right? And then I also teach Third World Women, La Chicana, I'm going to teach again. So, you know, my training's in like history, cultural studies, ethnic studies, women's studies. So I also do like women's studies, and I also teach grad classes. You know, theory classes and cultural studies classes for our graduate program as well. I've even taught a hip hop and Chicano Latino urban space class. Nice. I've taught that. So,
have you published in relationship to the work that you do with the lowrider?
Yeah. So I have a couple pieces that are in some anthologies. The other big book that I edited that's not connected to Lorraine, but my other area of looking at community history and marginalized communities and the role of culture and art spaces mm-hmm. of my work with the Achucha. So I edited a two-volume system called volume with my colleagues, three of my colleagues in ethnic studies called Whitewashing American Education, the New Ethnic Studies Culture Wars. And first volumes on high school, K-12, and then higher ed. And so it's on ethnic studies practitioners of how we can put ethnic studies in the classroom, how it informs our work as scholars. Uh-huh. So I'm very proud of that.
That will be such a useful tool for a lot of our listeners. Yeah. Can they find that in Amazon?
Yeah. Or? So, yeah, so it's Whitewashing American Education, the New Ethnic Studies Culture Wars. The best thing for the listeners is that you're connected to a university is have them buy the volumes because they have them like an ebook, and then mm-hmm. you can have access to all the chapters.
Because
otherwise, I think it's kind of expensive because it's considered reference. But I'm so proud of it. It took me. I'll never want to edit a book again. It was so much work. So much work. But it was so important because I felt that having been a graduate of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley, it was sort of my gift back, you know, mm-hmm. looking back. And I realized having taught for 20 years, I have a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge. So do my colleagues, that we need to share this work. In fact, in a time period, like we were doing this book, like right after the Arizona stuff happened. But then even now they're trying to create ethnic studies requirement in California public schools, right? Oh, and it's a awesome. National thing. So I think it's important that we share our expertise, share our work, and also, again, you know, build solidarity mm-hmm. because the need for ethnic studies in our curriculum, it's so important.
Yes.
And the need for activists as well.
So I want to get back to the Lowrider show up at the Peterson now. But before we get into that, I've been having really amazing conversations with you since I've met you, and I'm so glad that we connected and you reached out, and I'm so happy to be in that show that you curated. But something that we're always talking about on the podcast is like all these identifiers, right? So we are Latinos who lunch, and a lot of people actually have a problem with the word Latino because it has an O on it. It's not gender inclusive. The new term now is Latinx. Mm-hmm. But then a lot of times, Babalito and I talk about it here is, I'm curated into a lot of shows with Chicanos, Chicanx people, and I'm technically not a Chicano. And I had to kind of come to the realization that nowadays, you know, sometimes a lot of curators will, you know, they will just say like, okay, this is a Chicano show, and then somehow just figure out how to put me in it, you know? And I have actually, now I identify as Chicano because I... Right. because I've been part of these shows and the community has embraced my artwork.
Right.
And right now I'm in a show at the Museo de las Americas about Pachuco culture.
Right.
In Denver. And Denver and all the, and you know, right. It says all the artists are Chicano. So I kind of want to talk about those identities and like kind of what you think about the terms.
I think to begin with is we have to talk about that Chicano is an aesthetics, right? And it has a cultural history in institutions and in the art world, right? So I think the one thing when you look at sort of my generation and the work that was coming out in the 90s of talking about, very influenced by Anzaldúa, right? And the idea of like
the borderlands.
The borderlands and hybridity. You know, you would have somebody like in the 90s, Beck, who grew up in Silver Lake, you know, white guy, was saying he's Chicano because he liked how Chicano is no categories, right? Border. And he grew up in an area where he was mixed and he was in that culture influenced who he was, right?
That's what that album, Güero, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, back in the 90s, shit. Right? And so I think what's really important is that I would argue it's not, look it, I have lowriders that are white guys that grew up in Montebello around Chicanos, considered themselves Chicanos, know more about. I think lowriding is the perfect sort of venue to answer this because when I was doing this research, I would meet people that knew, were using Chicano, knew about the history because they read Lowrider magazine, white guys, Asian guys that consider themselves Chicano. You would hear them talking, you would think they were Chicano. So that ethnicity is not necessarily blood. Right? Yes. Culture, environment also impacts who you are, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's important. And I think the one thing is that Chicano, yes, it's an identity politics, but it's also placemaking, right? It's also aesthetics. It's all these larger things as well.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because in the lowriding community, it was interesting because like talking about teaching, you know, I have to explain to my students still what is Chicano. Most of them don't know what Chicano is. Mm-hmm. They signed up for this class, right? But in the lowriding, I would be interviewing and most of them had a common language or definition. So I thought, wow, like there's that jump right there of different. The other thing of going with Latinx, Chicanx, I know it's the big word that we're using and I think it's important. Reality, the students that I teach, 80 students last year that I asked, these are mostly from the Northeast San Fernando Valley, if they had ever heard of Chicanx or Latinx.
Five of them did.
Yep. But you come to East LA, it would probably be different, right? So I think that's the problem, right? Is that it's we're using this language and not necessarily people identify with it, right? And I think it's important to have these discussions and talk to them about it. You could go the same way because my students don't identify with Chicano and they take my class and many of them at the end will say, I am Chicana at the end. So I'm not saying since they don't connect, don't talk about it.
Yeah.
You have to talk about it, right?
And I think we also need to start thinking, and we started talking about it with Maite from Cabronas y Chingonas, of how many times or how much some of these identifiers and these categories end up reinforcing the same things we want to erase.
Right.
So sometimes we want to show that we're diverse and we're different, and by creating subcategories of subcategories, we end up reinforcing those stereotypes that in a way we try to stay away from. And it happens a lot. I mean, there are efforts, and I'm glad that we're having those conversations, but many times having those categories is just not the answer, which is, I mean, it's very complicated, right?
Well, like for instance, some of me and my friends were talking about for a while everybody was using the A
or
the Chicano
Latinao.
Like that went away, right? I remember a conference presentation, you probably remember too, like, you know, five, 10 years ago, like every conference paper, right, was like, and you don't see that anymore. Now it's the X, right? X. So I keep thinking, what's going to be the next thing that's happening? But I think to kind of pull it back, I think, you know, my generation, since I came sort of after, you know, I was in the 90s, like, so we fought really hard to have the /A/O.
Yeah.
Right. And I was even talking to some of my queer colleagues that in the same sort of generation, right? Like they go, well, we fought really hard for that. So what we're doing is like doing /A/O/X, right? Which it gets complicated, but it makes sense because they said we can't forget that history of that slash and the work that went into that.
Yeah.
And I always thought and it's important, right?
Yeah, of course.
Because the X, it says it erases that, but not all the X is like grounded in feminist and all this kind of like liberation theory. So it gets problematic, right?
Yeah.
And then some of the problems I'm seeing is like even with the PST shows, especially the shows that had to deal with the Chicano movement, when writers of the LA Times or blogs were talking about Chicanx, during the Chicano movement. That didn't exist back then.
Right.
And they called themselves, you had a movement that called itself Chicano. Mm-hmm. That's the terminology. So you have to honor that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe explain if you're going to use Chicanx for contemporary. But then it gets complicated, right? So that's what you're saying. Then it adds these layers of complication that are not bad. But then it takes us away from really what the issue is. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the issues that we should be focusing on?
Yeah, the big themes always get erased because we're
like homophobia or racism or even like assimilation and the issues it creates, tensions, cultural tensions among our communities or being Central American versus like Chicano. But so I think it's important, right, that we can get, language is important, yes, but the other part is the actions and the social justice that has to happen. I always tell my students that they always teach you that knowledge is power, and I tell them, I'm going to push you. It's what you do with that knowledge that's power.
Correct.
Mm.
You know, and that's the step I want them to take to be, you know, agents of social change and warriors in the struggle for social justice.
Yes.
And language is a part of that, but we can't forget sort of that action, the action side of it, you know? And it's a fascinating discussion, and I'm waiting for somebody, and I wish I'm just not in that head and I would have to think about it, but I don't know how nobody has written about how the slash and the A slash O could be Nepantla or Anzaldúa. Like, the slash is that mediator. It's the liminality. You could redefine the slash as liminal space. And Anzaldúa talks about that. So I was like, how come nobody, we couldn't redefine the slash?
Yeah.
Instead of creating another new little, an X.
I think somebody, I saw somewhere that somebody was using the U.
Or the E now.
The E.
Latine. Yeah, because it makes more sense. Next topic.
What do you think?
What? No, I think that it's just dangerous sometimes as liberal people, you know, like I feel like I'm pretty liberal when it comes to some things, but most things, I would say. But the problem that I find a lot of times is like creating an umbrella term and then fitting everybody in it.
Yeah.
And now it's like, yeah, like the LA Times always uses the word Latinx to describe a large number of people.
Right.
When really, if it's like something that happened to a Salvadoran person, it's good to let people know that it was a Salvadoran person.
Right.
To let people know that those people actually exist.
Because
most Central Americans, for example, are erased.
Right.
So shout out to all my Central Americans out there. I'm actually half Guatemalan.
Right.
So, and you know, I barely talk about it, right? But because that's how I've been conditioned my whole life. But so I think that's dangerous. And I actually was interviewed recently. And, you know, because of the conversations we've had, this reporter was like, or journalist, I should say, said, so, you know, America is a big melting pot of this, this, and that. And what is the message that you want to send to America, this great nation of this, you know, they love using that word melting pot. And I'm like, and I'm like, I think the term melting pot is a tool of white supremacy.
Oh, it is. Who still uses the melting pot?
And the lady was like silent on the line.
That just shows their own like ignorance.
Because
they use mosaic, they use quilt, you know, all these new like white neoliberists. Like, who uses the melting pot? That tells you what they're not reading or they're not doing.
Yeah, I'm like, I think we should all celebrate our differences and identify them,
right?
And not just erase it. It's like I told her, it's like when white people say they don't see color,
right?
And there was like just silence on the other side of the line,
right?
That's one of the things this philosopher Emmanuel Levinas says. Instead of like identifying with the other and trying to see each other, what we have in common, we have to celebrate the integrity of our differences. That's when change actually
that's
happens.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. And I think to get back to your question, which you asked, that Chicano, the art world, it's like a state of mind, you know? So you literally can be white and be Chicano because it's where you identify yourself with, the politics, where you see the cultural work that you're doing is important.
Yeah.
And also because your art is part of that history making that we're doing in institutions, but from your point of view, right?
Right.
And so I think it's important to talk about that in the art world, that Chicano art, it's a philosophy, it's an aesthetics, it's a politics, but it's like a way, it's a philosophy, you know, way of being, right?
Yes.
And so you fit in that category.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I talked about it a little bit at the Peterson when we did our talk with with all the artists, a lot of the artists that were in the show. Who was it? It was Elrod.
It was Leon Elrod, Marina Perez Wong,
yes,
both from the Bay Area, and then Esteban O'Neill, the OG from LA.
Oh my gosh, he's so awesome.
Yeah.
I was saying, like, I think a lot of times I didn't identify as Chicano because I didn't want to come off as a fraud or like as a poser because, you know, I know a lot of Chicanos and like Cholos from Las Vegas who are like, you go for the Raiders, fool, you ain't really Chicano, like, get out of here.
But
so it's like, you know, like,
but that's,
that's
one,
you know,
definition of being Chicano.
Right, right.
Right, and that's the complicated thing, right? but I think in the art world, it's, I think, because of the shows that you've been in, you've also had to educate yourself.
Totally.
Right, and also you realize, oh, there's a community that I do fit in here.
Totally.
Right? So it's a curator that works on this topic. Mm-hmm. What are the things that you always keep in mind when putting together a show so you don't fall into the same categories or you don't fall into some of the mistakes that other institutions have done to disservice the community?
And I think the show at the Peterson right now would be a nice thing to talk about because the way that you curated that show, I saw that you paid attention to kind of all facets of lowrider culture.
This show... Like, all my experience played out in this show. Because, like, you think of 20-plus years from being a student, professor, educator, all of that, is that you essentially right now have an unabashedly Chicano art show in this very white institution.
Yes. So white.
Right? And it's written in the language for our community. So there's going to be people that get some things and don't get things. And I like that, right? It doesn't, and if they don't, they can look it up, right? Mm-hmm. But that it had to be authentic to that culture and that community. So when you go back, especially in something I said earlier, especially with low riding, is that I have to make sure that the low riders, like, this is honest to who they are and authentic. And this is true.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's really important. So that when they come and they get it. And there's some things in that show that if you're a low rider, you're the only one that'll get that. Mm-hmm. And so the multiple ways that you have to create an experience to speak to multiple audiences.
Yes.
Always it's education. Two, I think it's always social justice is at play because we're talking about chapters in our history. Like my last show, La Vida Lowrider in 07-08, it was really about LA history, even though we use lowriders to tell the story, and we told black and brown history and talked about the zoot suits and talked about the impact of Vietnam. There were all these panels on the wall with like large panels, and the museum was like, we can't do this. And I'm like, yeah, you're gonna do it. We had like 22 panels in that. I even had a panel on Gwen Stefani and like the manipulation of, you know, sort of culture and appropriation. So I think it's also important is that museums are educating spaces, and they're supposed to be democratizing spaces, but we know that's not always at play.
Right.
So I think what's important is because I am an outsider to these institutions, I view myself as an outsider. So I'm also raising questions to them. There's things that I could raise. And there's things that also I can't even, he'll know, as an artist, can't even make answers or give answers to because I don't have the power, right? I have some power, but not a lot of power in that institution. Because I'm a curator from the outside, right? A consultant or one they brought in, right?
But that's so essential.
Yeah. But it's different. I think the politics might be completely different if I had to be there like 7 days, you know, 5 days a week, see these
and
people.
And this was just another show.
Cultural politics and the silencing. And I've heard some from other my friends that are curators. It's a different world, right? But the other part, too, I think it's important of being authentic, true, right, to the community that you're representing. And it literally is for them.
Yes.
Because it's written from their experience and their language, and I want them to get it and appreciate it.
But that's exactly what I was mentioning. You don't put yourself in the center.
Right.
So it's not about empathizing with the community, even though you're part of that community. Right. You step outside. You get yourself out of the equation.
Right.
You celebrate other people's differences and the differences and diversity within the community. And the result is a great show.
Right. Right. And the show really, people really have connected to it. And it's funny because you do it and then you don't realize the impact, but you hear these great stories of how people really enjoy it. And I also think, like, I probably couldn't have done this show 10 years ago because it's my age. Because there was a certain knowledge that I have of Chicano art, of being Chicana myself, of teaching Chicano studies and ethnic studies for 20 years. And the art, a lot of my friends are artists. A lot of these artists are my friends that I knew the art that I wanted in that show. It was very clear what I wanted. It was like, as soon as they told me this art show was going to happen, some of the first pieces I got was his piñata and the cue sides. Okay? Now, those were two things that nobody had ever fucking seen in LA before, right?
Yes.
So I knew I was going to have the standards and all that, but to bring in things that people hadn't seen. And then people like some of the OGs, like OG Abel and Cartoon, like they actually wanted to create new pieces for the show, right? I just wanted some old pieces. They're like, no, we want, they got really excited, right?
That's awesome.
So I think bringing new, like the whole wall on gender politics was something I had been itching to do for years and years. Like in the past shows, I fought for a panel on women in lowriders, don't get me wrong, but to literally say in that panel, call out the sexism and misogyny that exists right in lowrider culture, and as well in all the world, as lowriding is not any different, but to show women now picking up the brush, picking up the camera,
yes,
creating space for women or queer right sort of positionalities in low riding, they also are part of that community, I think is really important. You know,
can you talk about the artists, the Q-Sides pieces?
Right.
Can you talk about those pieces?
So the Q-Side pieces, they're these photos where they sort of took like the East Side oldie CD covers that always have like a low rider and a hetero couple. It had those oldies music, and they sort of like queered those lenses, right?
Yeah.
And put like same-sex couples or a drag queen, like instead of like, you know, your sexy hot bikini mama, like a drag queen right in front of a lowrider. And they shot him around the Mission. And when that show was in 2015 in the Mission, I think it might have been in Galeria La Raza. I forget which Galeria.
Yeah, Galeria La Raza.
They got a lot of hate.
And
it had a very negative. And I remember reading about it and I was like, oh my God. So when this show happened, the first thing I had to track them down because I don't remember who the artists were. Luckily, I have artists, friends in San Francisco. So I said, there was this show. I remember reading about it. And they're like, oh, we'll find it. In an hour, I had their contacts, right? So they were kind of surprised, a little bit reticent too, because of based on the experience of their last show. But those pieces, we only have four. There's 13 pieces that your listeners should look up of the Q-Sides. You can find them. They're all online. So you could see these images that they recreated of like queering, right?
That's sort of
the traditional lowrider image. And advocating for their space. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful. And political and fierce, right? And so I think, you know, those images really, they really are amazing in the room with all the other art.
I have to tell you something. So I saw those images stuck with me. And I went to San Francisco in May. And I ran into a listener of Latinos Who Lunch. And we've talked about her a lot on the show. But her name is Persia. She's a drag queen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, she looks so familiar. And I met her out of drag. Okay. And then one day we went to this party at a bar somewhere in the Mission. And I saw Dulce de Leche. She's a drag queen there. And I'm like, oh my God, that's the drag queen that's in Q-Sides in the photo at the Peterson. And Persia's like, yeah, I'm in the photo too. And I'm like, no, bitch, no way. So it's so funny how that just like happened. Like, but I find that it just keeps happening within the art world is like when you see an artist that you like, you eventually start to work with them or like I end up in an art show with them.
Right.
So of course, my piñata is in the same exhibition as this drag queen that listens to our podcast. Right. Like everything is so connected. It's beautiful.
In there with Magoo's, our family car, with Mr. Cartoon. You know, so I feel like the show, like I now I can say I'm really proud of it. I think before it was like you're such a hit. It was so much work, but because we really put it together in a short amount of time, if you think about it. But I had laser focus. I knew what I wanted. Like, I knew the story. And I had a fight for some pieces. Like, they wanted, there was too much art. That's what they thought. And I was like, no, you're going to build me a wall. You're going to build me a wall in the middle of the room. And now that it's built there, they're using it for their other art show.
Yeah.
And I was like, nope. And they were just, I just knew, like, everything that was there. And then the other piece, too, was Ruben Ortiz Torres's scissor lift, High and Low, because I knew my show was going to be called The High Art of Riding Low.
Didn't he had a piece at the an art show at LACMA after the Chicano Movement was the name of the show, and it was coffins in the shape of people riding lowriders.
I don't know if I saw that. I know he had like a leaf blower.
Uh-huh.
Did he have coffins? I never seen that one.
They were coffins, but they were the shape of somebody sitting in a lowrider. like that's standing crazy. Back. So it just goes to show you that like you live and you died in that culture. It's so badass. Yeah.
He also did like leaf blowers as lowriders and the lawnmowers.
Oh yeah,
yes. As lowriders. That one's in Chicago. Ruben's amazing. He's from DF. He's like amazing, crazy in the genius type of way. So I knew I needed him in that show, and I've known him for a while. So a lot of these artists I've known, mm-hmm. and I know them because people were telling me, like, they go, you don't realize the show that you put together, like the amount of cultural cachet you have to bring these artists together. And because I've been doing the low riding for so long, I'm well known in the low riding, but also because I've been in the art world and I'm an academic, a lot of my friends are artists, you know, I know people, mm-hmm. right, as well. So it was sort of, in this exhibit, I think what I'm most proud of is we're taking sort of the lowrider car as object and subject and sort of bringing these different worlds together to create a conversation and experience for the viewer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's competing definitions of what it means to be a lowrider, how these aesthetics are used. And I think that's what's amazing, right, is that, you know, we took these guys that customized lowriders and they painted everyday objects, right, like lowriders. And we created an art installation of that.
And I see lowriders very similar to the way we approach murals, because people see them as lower art, right? With those fucked up hierarchies that we're still dealing with in these institutions. But when you think about the process of putting together a community-based mural, it's a lot. It's planning, it's drawing, it's colors, it's making sure that people pay attention when they're driving. There's so many things. So from beginning to end, it's a very complicated process. The same thing with a lowrider. It's not just about a shiny object.
Right.
It's about the year and the make of the car. It's about the paint. It's just so many things that when you get the final product, it really is a complete form of art.
It's a form of art. I mean, and it takes a lot of money to customize a rider.
Look, and community.
Like, we're talking about $100,000 minimum to have an award-winning car.
Yes.
And the other fascinating thing is that people are using these cars to tell their story.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's going back or taking it back to when I started this research and was interviewing the lowriders, you know, it was very clear to me is this is how we're telling our American story, you know, and a lot of them would say, when I would ask all of them the basic question, what does it mean for you to be a lowrider? And I would get these same responses, you know, it means a true lowrider lowrides from the heart. Lowriding is, you know, passion. It's hard work, right? It's corazón, it's family, it's brotherhood, right? So there is like certain codes of the boulevard, right? But there are also certain value system inherent in this that people miss, you know, especially the family and community building. And that's why I love that quote that Kita gave me many years ago that I had to put into this show of like, you know, lowriders were the Picassos of the boulevard. And I love that, right? He says, lowriders are a working man's work of art.
Yeah.
So that if we don't have the space in museums, the streets become our museums.
Correct.
Right?
And institutions are going to continue not to claim those objects and murals as pieces of art for two reasons, because they're made by brown people and because it doesn't play into the myth of the artist that one single person created this whole entire thing, as opposed to like a work of art that was created by a lot of people and has a lot of these values. It doesn't play into the games of the art world.
Well, the hierarchies. Correct. And that exists in the automotive world, because you could argue that there's a lot more value attached to hot rods and seen as a value of having aesthetic value, and lowriders are considered lowbrow, you know?
But man,
you know, there's so many books on hot rods. The History Channel just did two shows on the history of the hot rods. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of tension between the hot rods and the lowriders, because hot rod shows in the 50s and 60s and even in LA in the 70s, they wouldn't let lowriders be in their shows. There's been fights and throwdowns at shows against lowriders and hot rods. So hot riders sort of consider themselves a little bit better. And there's a lot of also rich white guys that own hot rods, but there's working class folks, right, in the hot rod. But I think even that, the value system of judging sort of like aesthetics of cars, you know, like we have right now the Porsche exhibit is on the other side of it. Before that, we had, what were the cars that we had there before? Those Italian cars, Bugatti.
Yeah.
And so I thought, so great how we're side by side, because these are like our Porsche, our Bugatti. It's funny because I look at the Porsche, I find them very boring.
Yeah.
Like in the colors, it's like very sterile, the lobby. Gray. Just very boring. Yeah. They're not that they're beautiful in their own right and people appreciate them. But it's like the low rise, there's something about the vibrance. And I think we were talking about that too, of like the color and the use of color is political. you know, it's disruptive, yeah. right? You're disrupting, sort of, and you're saying, look at me, look at me, and why that's so important in a culture, in our communities, where we're completely trying to be invisible, right? Or they want to put us into these boxes.
Yeah.
And we're saying, no, we're going to take the streets. We're going to use our the colors to tell our story.
Yeah.
You know, one of my lowrider friends who sadly passed away, Julio Ruelas, he would always tell you, that we get the colors from the Aztecs, from like the feathers on the headdresses. And he made a historical trajectory of how the Aztecs, they would have built cars like this, right? And it was so great. So he tells me that. And then you go to Chicano art history, and who was saying that in art history language? Magoo, Gilbert yeah. Magoo-Lohan, right? In his stories and like his codexes or the cruising through Aztlan, he's done exactly that. So you have two guys, damn. Right, that believe the same thing. Then they wouldn't see their worlds are completely different worlds in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. But they're saying the same thing.
Damn.
It's part of our history. It's in our genetic memory code.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, I think I need to take a break. That's a lot to think about. So, yeah, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back with our guest and maybe have some recommendations for everybody. Oh, my God. You are amazing. Insane. We could talk to you forever. Yeah. I have so much to say.
No,
yeah,
so
it's so good. Okay, I gotta go.
I feel like we're in a zone.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot we could talk about. We realize we could talk more about low riding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Ready?
Wait.
You guys talked a lot, so I'm gonna. Okay. And we're back. Hi. All right. Man, we could talk to you forever. This has been such a fascinating conversation. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have you back, because there's a lot of little pins I put into a lot of our conversations.
I feel we just touched a little bit on low riding, right? Of just la onda bajita, and just to always low and slow, and the politics of low and slow. And,
yeah.
And I'm going to encourage our listeners more than ever to go to our website, because putting images to all the things that we've been talking about will be so interesting. So the conversation is fascinating in itself. If you add that the images of some of these artists, it will be even more interesting. So
we didn't even talk about the Gypsy Rose.
I know.
We'll talk about her next time.
We have to, because
we're gonna
explain how you said that the Gypsy Rose is the ultimate drag queen at the presentation, and people were on the floor.
Died.
I went on the floor. Did you see me? I went on the floor.
I died too. It was so my good. God.
And you,
so
and you good. And you talked about how you just hit you at that it hit you at that moment. And I told the owner of Gypsy Rose that.
¿Y qué dijo?
And he loved it.
Yeah,
he got it. He got what I was saying. He got when I said the explanation.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about.
We'll talk about that on another episode. And actually, after that, I realized a couple of artists have already kind of explored that. So we can talk about that too.
Of it as drag.
Yeah.
Drag.
Yeah. Which is really interesting. Oof. Yeah. Okay. Who wants to go first?
Go for it.
Our guest, go ahead.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is recommend.
Yeah, whatever you want.
So since I found out my recommendation has already been recommended, I think I'm going to go back, and try to pick two women that have influenced my feminist thinking.
Yes.
And one of those was Sheri Moraga, who was one of the Chicana writer, lesbian, very active in the Chicano movement, but started Kitchen Table Press. Out of Berkeley, put this bridge called My Back, but to read Loving in the Warriors, anything by Sheri Moraga, she's so amazing, changed my life. She has Waiting in the Wings, Portrait of Queer Motherhood. She's amazing. And Loving in the Warriors is her classic book, so to start there. And then the other sort of godmother who I think informed all my thinking was Bell Hooks. Ain't I a Woman by Bell Hooks, that she wrote when she was 18, 19. And she's written many, many books, like all about love and teaching as praxis and love, teaching as act of love, all these things. But reading Ain't I a Woman, and I mean, those are, I think, two essential reading books that I feel that I always try to tell my students that, like, they always, like, read the cutting edge stuff, but nobody goes back and reads Paulo Freire, right? Or reads Frantz Fanon, or reads W. Du Bois. Like, they don't read the origin of all of these authors that have been inspired by that. So, like, Frantz Fanon, Black Skin, White Mask,
that book
essential.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, taking it back.
Yes. Important.
Well, right now I've actually been reading a couple of books, and because I got my recommendation is going to be Roxane Gay. I really love Roxane Gay, and one thing that she says that now I repeat whenever I do a talk or anything is like, white people are always allowed to be mediocre, and they're like successful at being mediocre. And something that I say now to kids, people of color or queer people that are afraid to jump in and do something, to just do it. And even if you're not the best at it, just do it. Because as people of color, we're always expected to be excellent at everything. Or like, that's why I find like shows like Queer Eye very problematic, because like you have to be the expert at doing what you're doing to even be considered relevant or important. Right. Right? No, you can be bad at something and you can get better at it, and that's okay. Anyway, she has the book Bad Feminist, and she has the book Hunger, which I really want to read, but I don't want to read it until I finish Bad Feminist, because I've only read articles and essays about her online. I've never finished a whole book of essays from her. So I'm in the middle of reading Bad Feminist right now, and it's great. So if you don't know who Roxane Gay is, get on it. She's like all over the internet with a lot of hot takes, and she's just unapologetically like black, feminist, queer, you name it.
Badass,
yeah.
Awesome. So I'm very disillusioned with the institution that is the museum. I have a lot of problems with the museums, but once in a while, like your exhibition, Denise, there are things that are going to change the game, and how do we see things? When a museum recontextualizes the way I see things, that's when I know that's a successful exhibition. And there's very few of those in history from what I or that I have experienced. And I want to recommend a catalog that if you go to Amazon, you can buy for like a dollar. However, this is one of the greatest exhibitions. This was called The West as America. This was an art exhibition in the Smithsonian. This was back in 1991. It is so good that the Congress threatened to take the money away from the Smithsonian. Like the Smithsonian's almost fell because of this exhibition, because this is the first exhibition in the United States that actually portrayed the United States as this like imperialist, westward colonialists.
Right.
So Manifest Destiny, they didn't take that bullshit. So all those Remington-like type of paintings, they were contextualized with the scholarship and the way that it was created to show that America had this it was propaganda. Those images are propaganda, and as opposed to seeing the images as this romantic thing.
Right. And that's a good, just to, the historian in me, we have to contextualize it because that's coming out of the first Bush years,
mm-hmm.
where there was all these attacks on the NEH and art,
correct.
Right? And all of those, like, they wanted sort of that master white narrative that's always been. And
right.
So they were, you know, pulling money, pulling funding, mm-hmm. talking about how curriculums, you know, had to teach the American way. And
right.
So I think it's important to sort of why that's so important, because it's in that context.
And the,
that we're going back to right now.
Right, exactly. So the beauty of the internet is that because this was so successful and unsuccessful at the same time for many, many reasons, some people lost their jobs. I mean, it's like a whole very dramatic story behind it. But because of the internet, you can find the catalog. I bought like three catalogs. They were like $3 each one. And the essays on that catalog are brilliant. The painting is filled with images. I cannot recommend it enough. Again, once in a while, there's some good exhibitions out there, and when they are, we have to juice them, because they have the potential to change the world, mm-hmm. to change the at least the art world. Again, the exhibition is The West as America, and that's all you have to do. Google La Loca. You'll find her on Amazon, and yes, that's my recommendation.
Oh my gosh, Doctora Denise Sandoval, muchísimas gracias for being on Latino
Soul
Lunch.
Yes, this is an honor. This is amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. We had a lot to talk about.
Yes.
I feel like
yes.
I could go on and on to talk about lowriders.
Yes, we need to have you back on and get into it. I would love that. And again, as a reminder, if you are in the Los Angeles area, Corazón e Inspiración, the high art of writing low is at the Peterson through... I think through at least the beginning of September.
Early
so you
September.
Still have some
yeah.
time this summer to check it out.
And the museums open up late this summer till 8 o'clock.
And you know what? I'm not really a car person, even though I make lowriders.
But it's a beautiful museum.
The Lowrider Show, of course, is a reason to go see it. But they have floors and floors of beautiful. I mean, I'd say a lot of these cars are art. I mean,
the Batmobile.
Oh my gosh, the Batmobile's there. Lightning McQueen from Cars is there. Yep. It's so awesome. It's a really cool place to take your family, and you know, and it makes art a little bit more accessible, even though the building you don't know what it is
monstrous.
When you look at it.
I can't.
It's like a Hot Wheels.
Yeah.
Right, and it's supposed to be a heart.
A hot, like a hot rod. Yeah.
I don't get it.
Okay.
All right. Just remember, low and slow is where it's at.
Low and slow.
Bajito y suavecito, baby.
Oh! And as always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Send us your emails. AskLWLpod@gmail.com. Again, AskLWLpod@gmail.com. And we might read your questions on the air. If you can, go to our website. You can donate to keep Latinos Who Lunch going. If not, at least leave us a review, fools. 5 stars.
5 stars only.
And, you know, the more reviews we have, the more visible we are.
And visibility leads to representation, which is very important.
Yeah. Today's episode was produced by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega. Our intern is Carla Lagunas. Marketing assistance from Hector Aguilar. Music by the band Brownout. I'm Bobby Fav.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.